Hello, you're listening to a Sydney Writers Festival podcast. I hope you enjoy this conversation from our 2020 podcast series.
My name's Scintilla Chingaipe. I'm a journalist and filmmaker, and I will be leading the conversation today with Nicole Dennis-Benn. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which these events ordinarily take place, and pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. I'd also like to acknowledge that I am recording this from the land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging, and also acknowledge any other elders that might be listening to this podcast today. I am delighted to be in conversation with Nicole Dennis-Benn, the author of Here Comes the Sun, a New York Times Notable Book of the Year and a 2017 Lambda Literary Award winner. Her best-selling sophomore novel, Patsy, which we'll be talking about today, is a 2020 Lambda Literary Award winner, a New York Times Editor's Choice, a Financial Times Critics' Choice, a Stonewall Book Awards Honor Book, and a Today Show Read with Jenna Book Club selection. Patsy has also been named the best book of the year by Kirkus Reviews, Time, NPR, People Magazine, The Washington Post, Apple Books, Oprah Magazine, The Guardian, Good Housekeeping, BuzzFeed, Elle, and many other publications. Patsy fills a literary void with compassion, complexity, and tenderness. That's how Time magazine raved about the book. And NPR names Dennis-Benn as an indispensable novelist. Dennis-Benn was born and raised in Kingston, Jamaica. She's a graduate of St. Andrew High School for Girls and Cornell University, and holds a Master of Public Health from the University of Michigan and an MFA in Creative Writing from St. Lawrence College. Dennis-Benn is the founder of the Stuyvesant Writing Workshop and lives with her wife in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival podcast, Nicole.
Yes, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. I'm just sorry that we can't be having this conversation in person.
I know.
but I thought we would begin with just a brief summary of Patsy for our audience.
Yes. So Patsy follows the life of a woman who wants to find her place in the world. That's her main desire. And so she leaves her working class community of Pennyfield, Kingston, in search of better opportunities abroad. And also to reunite with her best friend, Cicely, who lives in Brooklyn, New York, writes her these beautiful letters saying that they can actually love the way they want to love in a place like America. In addition to that, Patsy secretly is running away from motherhood, a role that she didn't feel prepared to play, a role that she thought she never really had the choice in the beginning to even embrace. And so for her, it's really just finding her place, and it's really a coming of age novel of this woman who ultimately comes into herself, embracing who she is, and also ultimately, yes, embracing her responsibilities. But the book also follows her daughter, True, who was left behind in Jamaica, who also comes of age, questioning her mother's abandonment, something that Patsy now has to earn back, that trust, from her daughter. And so it really taps into motherhood, belonging, acceptance, and really ultimately asks the question, what do we lose or gain when we choose ourselves as women, especially as women in society?
It's interesting hearing you say that because, one of the things about it is that it pulls so many themes, and it's the layers as you're reading through that it never feels like you're being overwhelmed as you're unpacking everything that's impacting Patsy's life. But I was wondering if at this stage we could just dive into a bit of a reading and then start, delving into Patsy's story.
Definitely. All right, so where I'm going to read from actually is the middle of the book. So I'm going to start here where Patsy's in the U.S. and she's grappling with her choices or lack thereof. There are two types of devil's cold. One in which you cannot bring yourself to leave the room, much less the bed, to do the simplest things. And the other in which you go through the motions in a constant stupor. Patsy lies in bed, turned away from the dark, heavy thing. that has returned, its shadow dimming the room. With a cover over her head, she closes her eyes, not wanting to see it. God knows how long she has gone without eating. She could die, she knows, though death doesn't seem that scary after all. Not as scary as the dark thing. Here in America, there are no bush teas for it. No bitter mix of ram goat roses, rosemary, lemongrass, bissy, and other herbs. No pasta to come with a bottle of sanctified olive oil. No neighbor from the country who can wring the neck of a goat and sever it with a machete for you to bathe in its blood. No time to lie down and let it run its course. She's powerless against it. The real hell is allowing this place to eat you alive, Fiona says to Patsy, when she notices that she has been lying in the same spot on the bed inside their studio from sunup till sundown. How many rotations has the sun gone through since Patsy climbed in the bed that night after seeing Cicely? She slips in and out of sleep. She wakes to Fiona shaking her. Patsy? 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 It reminds Patsy of her daughter's voice, how it would pull Patsy from the lips of a deep sleep. Here she is in the midst of it, hating it, terrified of it, and yet her only thought is of True. During those years, it was the anticipation of going to America to see Cicely that had kept Patsy alive. But what is keeping her alive now? Where will she find the strength that would protect her from the spells? How can she live knowing that she lost Cicely to her American dream? It's then that what Fiona had said about not having the luxury of choosing love makes sense to Patsy. That's what it all comes down to. Choice. When has she ever been given a choice? Never. She was never given the choice to say no the first time her legs were pried open. Never given a choice to rid her body of the grievance she had to carry for 9 months. Never given a choice to look at another woman and allow herself to be carried by the feeling without blood, bright red on glistening glass, sticking to her like shadow. And now the promise of life comes with accepting the fact that she will never have a choice.
Gosh. Every time I kept reading, my heart was just being broken. I mean, some of the experiences that Patsy had to endure, it just, I mean, the way you wrote it in a way that still gave Patsy her humanity was incredible, because I tell you, every time I was just like, oh my God. There was one particular moment that I couldn't help but cry. Like, I was just like, this is, because I could empathize with that, with exactly what you talk about, that idea of lack of choice, you know?
Yes.
So I want to start, I guess, where the reading leaves us, which is Patsy's in New York and right there, and the immigrant experience that she's having, which is very different from the ideas that she had about what New York might be.
Yes.
And I'm curious about that. I'm curious about exploring that side of the immigrant experience, of the grass isn't always greener on the other side.
Yes. Exactly. A lot of immigrants come to America with that vision, with that hope that it is completely different, that the roads are paved with gold here. As for the UK and also Canada, but yes, a lot of working class Jamaican immigrants leave the island in droves with hope of better opportunity, upward mobility, which is completely hard for working class Jamaicans back home. You know, there's literally a concrete ceiling to rise above your social class. And so a lot end up coming to places like America. So Patsy ends up coming here to the U.S. with that hope that, yes, she can actually dream here. She can actually love the way she wants to love here. You know, she can actually have choices here. You know, something that she didn't have a choice back home. You know, when she was pregnant with True, you know, abortion is illegal in Jamaica. So even that added, you know, anxiety of how is she going to raise a child that she didn't even want. You know, America provided that freedom for her, that escape. And she thought, in all honesty, she really thought America was going to wipe away all her problems. Mm. You know, it was going to be the only thing that was keeping her alive in Jamaica was the hope of coming to America. And of course, to be with Cicely, the love of her life, or her best friend, who she had known and had been in love with since primary school days in Jamaica. So yes, really, she was coming with that hope that a lot of us immigrants come with.
So it's interesting that you talk about how Patsy, prior to going to America, felt like she didn't really have a choice. You know, she didn't have choices, or things were taken away from her. You know, she didn't have the choice whether or not to abort. She didn't have a choice about her body. But it's interesting because, you know, she's a working class woman, dark skinned. By the way she describes herself, she almost describes herself as very unconventional in her beauty in some ways. And I wonder if the choice to go to America is a choice that she even has to make, as in, would she go to America if her situation was different? You know, if she was lighter skinned like Cicely, if she came from a middle class family in Jamaica, if she managed to finish her education, would she have left Jamaica?
That's a very good question. And in all honesty, no. You know, I always say this over and over again whenever people ask me, you know, why would you leave such a paradise? You know, because people look at Jamaica as a paradise. You know, they see the Sandals commercial and they think about Bob Marley and smoking weed all day and all that and being on the beach, right? And would question, why would anyone leave? And what they don't understand is that if you're a working class Jamaican who has no opportunities at all, you have to leave. You know, there's no questions about that. So usually there's a long line at the embassy, at the U.S. embassy or the British embassy or the Canadian embassy, whichever one of them, for people to leave for better opportunities. And like I said, working class Jamaicans, which are mostly the darker skinned Jamaicans, like the Patsies, like my father who left before me, who was an undocumented immigrant in the U.S., but had they the opportunity, the education, the skin color? No. You know, a lot of the Jamaicans who are remaining on the island, who are enjoying the island as a paradise, are the upper class wealthy Jamaicans. The ones who don't have to leave, the ones who have their yachts and Maiden Cay or Maiden Lane Island, the ones who can, you know, roam around the country on their four-wheel Range Rovers, you know, have parties. Like, those Jamaicans don't have to leave. The Jamaicans who leave, like I said, are the ones who just can't afford to feed their own families in a place where we should have been able to do that. We should have been able to have ownership of our land. You know, the farmers should have been able to export their own products, but we don't have that. And so, yes, many of us defeated leave.
Mm. It's interesting that when she gets to New York, she recognizes a similar truth, you know, that the New York of the movies, the New York of the TV shows,
right,
is the one that's assigned to other people, you know. Again, skin color, big part of it, but also class in many ways. And I was interested about that. I love that you placed her in Brooklyn pre-gentrification.
Yes.
And you know, how you use Patsy to sort of make this commentary in many ways about where Brooklyn is now and the people like the Patsies who no longer can call it their home. But it was interesting because it was a very specific world as well, because she, you know, I think it was only once in the book that she actually, when she goes with Cicely to Manhattan, but after that, she's spending a lot of time in communities where people outside of work, where people look like her or people are in a similar situation like her. And I'm curious about that side of New York, because again, for a lot of people, the New York that they come in contact with is the New York of the movies, the Manhattan, the island, the, you know,
right,
cosmopolitans from Sex and the City. And I wonder... I'm curious about that choice, about the choice of taking us into that world, taking us to Brownsville, and you know, these are very specific places, and mm-hmm. they conjure up a specific memory. And I'm just very interested in that, and even just the parts of Brooklyn that she frequents, and the Fulton Street Mall,
yes,
and all of that.
Yeah, it's interesting because I always think Here Comes the Sun was a love letter to Jamaica. I think Patsy is kind of like a love letter to both Jamaica and Brooklyn, where I currently reside. You know, because, you know, in all honesty, I love Brooklyn because that's where I feel at home, away from home. You know, so I did, you know, in terms of the pockets, the immigrant pockets, Crown Heights, Brownsville, I mean, not to the extent of Crown Heights, East Flatbush. You know, I wanted to pay homage to those places in the book. And knowing that that's where a lot of immigrants come and feel like they belong, you know. Of course, after the disappointment or the letdown of coming to America with hopes of it looking like how it looked in Sex and the City or in Breakfast at Tiffany's, you know. I even remember distinctly when I first came to America to visit, you know, this was like back in 93 to visit my father here. And I just remember I was staying in Queens, but it was like a black neighborhood in Queens. And I'm like, oh, but where are the white people? You know, because in your mind, America is sold to the world as a white country. You know, when you watch Full House, when you watch, you know, all the TGI Fridays, I think they used to have that. I used to a cable in Jamaica that was what was sold to us. And so you come to a new country and you're expecting that the people would look like that, they won't look like you, but you're still fascinated by it, right? So coming here, you know, Patsy also has that same mentality where she was looking around like, you know, in Brooklyn as Cicely drove, like, oh, where are the white people? And it was just an innocent question. In that, you know, yes, now she has landed in a foreign land. And, you know, again, that was just the tip of the iceberg in terms of her reality. You know, the fact that, well, most of the time she is going to be relegated to the immigrant ghettos, the population where people look like her. Because, of course, she cannot afford the new Brooklyn. You know, she cannot afford what Marcus Salters, who's the real estate person / mayor wannabe, wants to get Brooklyn to, right? The Patsies of our world, undocumented immigrants, they can only survive if there are people willing to cheapen the rent. You know, people like, you know, living in like a room in a house, for example. A lot of them end up doing that. A lot of them end up having to pay under the table because they don't have the documentation for, like, you know, a down payment on a house or you know, security deposit on like legit apartments. You know, so it's really those pockets in Brooklyn, the Brownsville, the East New York, the East Flatbush, the Crown Heights, that really can, those immigrants like a Patsy can afford to live. So yes, I really wanted to tap into that and tap into the coming gentrification that ultimately would push those people out. You know, because really what's happening is that most of the cities now are trying to accommodate more wealthier New Yorkers to come in, wealthy white New Yorkers.
And I couldn't help but think about, given the context that we were in globally, I couldn't help but think about the Patsies across the world that are in many ways the lifelines of our cities, yet are underpaid, undervalued, and the language now that's being used to describe those people is essential workers, frontline workers, and yet very little will change or is being done to sort of remedy their experiences as right. some of the most underpaid people in our cities. And I found it very interesting. I found it very interesting that here was this woman who, aside from her early protestations of not wanting to take on a lowly job, because here she was a woman who'd come from a public service job in Jamaica to clean toilets. But when she finally made peace with her reality and she got on with it, and there was a sad irony when she became a nanny and was taking care of these people's children, yet she'd left her own daughter behind. That broke me. I won't lie. I read that and I really just thought, gosh, Patsy, I don't know how you're doing it. I really don't know how you're doing it. 'Cause the guilt, you know, would have been just too much to bear. And so I want to touch on that relationship, her relationship with True, and the sense of her leaving to just give herself a sense of freedom because she'd entered this relationship with her daughter not necessarily out of choice. And it was a bold decision in many ways, because I don't know how many women would pick up and leave their five-year-old daughter and indefinitely move to another country.
Yes. Yeah, she really wanted that freedom. In that, one of the driving forces of Patsy leaving her daughter was because she didn't feel she could offer her anything. You know, at that point in Patsy's life, she was in deep self-loathing, as has always been since she was a 9-year-old child, looking at her own mother who left her, not in a physical sense, but in an emotional sense. You know, her mother, Mama G, you know, was in the church, and, you know, there were more Jesus figurines around the house than food in the cupboard. And Patsy, seeing that, wasn't really able to, wasn't able to discern what motherhood is, you know, and fearing that she would become her mother, ultimately turns away from True. She pushes True to her father, Roy, who she thought would be the better parent to raise True. So coming to America again, that choice, the only choice she has ever made in her life, was really on a dime that, okay, she can finally, reinvent herself, you know, in the truest form. And yes, ironically, she ends up as a nanny. And, you know, it was me trying to get her in that hot seat, you know, the irony, the guilt associated with that, you know, her now seeing that, well, you know, here she's raising other people's children while her own is at home. And she has no idea what's going on with True, because it's not like she sends True letters or calls or anything. You know, it's a clear, clean cut. And for Patsy, that she walks, that's added guilt for her, you know, walking around undocumented. But in addition to that, with that guilt of abandoning her child. And, you know, again, too, when you, as an immigrant looking to the U.S., she never even anticipated doing any of these jobs. You know, in her mind, she was going to come to the U.S. and thrive even higher than the public service job that she had. You know, but to come to America to clean toilets and then, of course, nanny other children, that was a shock to her system. And she ended up having to realize that, well, in this place, you have to survive. And really, that's what her roommate slash co-worker, Fiona, tries to tell her. You don't have a choice here either. You know, so again, she sinks into this deep depression because, you know, the scene I just read when she says to herself, has she ever been given a choice? Never. So ultimately realizing that there, you know, it's a lose-lose situation regardless of the country in which she resides.
Hmm. What I loved about the book is how you also introduced True's voice. So just as we're experiencing Patsy's discovery of America and the realizations that she's making, we're also navigating that with True. And what I loved about that is that generally when we think about the immigrant experience, it generally focuses on the people that leave and their choice to leave and that conflict and tension. But what you've done is that you've also explored the impact that it has on those that are left behind, you know?
Yes.
And that was hard. Imagining this young girl that idolized her mother in so many ways and just was waiting on this promise that she would return. But also you touched on the fact that Patsy went into a depression, but True also was sort of, you know, mentally impacted by the trauma of her mother abandoning her. And I'm curious about that. I'm curious about that exploration of True's experience.
Yeah, so True, True comes of age with this questioning, you know, this constant questioning of whether or not her mother will come back, you know. And, you know, it spans 10 years because Patsy left True when she was 5 years old. You know, and she left her with one promise only, you know, be a good, obedient girl and I'll be back for you. And for True, that was unfair as well because, you know, Patsy's words actually caged True because, you know, as you'll find as you read the book, realizing that True doesn't identify as a girl to begin with, you know, and in addition to that, it's also a lie in that Patsy's never coming back. You know, and so based on all of those factors, True herself still also comes of age with that added guilt. You know, what did I do wrong? You know, am I wrong? Is my mother not coming back because something, you know, that I did not do. All this questioning happens with True as she comes of age, and also coming into her own identity as gender nonconforming on an island where there's not many people like True. You know, so she doesn't even have the words to define what's going on with her. But still very much wanting her mother. But the thing that I gave True was community because, you know, Roy had stepped up as a father figure. You know, Roy actually gave True the freedom to be herself, to play soccer with the boys, to actually, you know, do whatever she wants to do in terms of roam around with her with men's clothes or with short hair. You know, he gave her that freedom. They became really close. And, you know, it begs the question, you know, people always say, okay, the mother is better at raising the girl. But it's actually, you know, True was, I feel like, a better rounded person with Roy being there. You know, Roy wasn't caging her in her in the gendered expectations of what a girl ought to be and ought to do. You know, so he gave her that freedom at least. And, you know, with that, True kind of finds that confidence, you know, to play football, to play soccer, you know, as she wanted to do. But still, there was that nagging, there was that void that Roy still wasn't able to fill. You know, the constant questioning of why hasn't her mother even reached out, you know, to say hello. You know, there was a comment that she made, you know, to Roy that, you know, in America, I'm sure there's telephones in a place like that, you know. So for her to, for this silence to be so prolonged, it didn't make sense to her at all. Yes, I wanted to give True side of the story, not only focus on Patsy's side, because yes, Patsy was the one who did the abandoning. And yes, it's important to write the stories of women who never felt motherhood is for them. And also immigrants who are coming here not being altruistic, you know, just coming here to find themselves, you know, for to better themselves. But for me, as a writer, I wanted to balance that with the child left behind, the barrel child, as we call him in the Caribbean, you know, who is told you ought to be grateful that the parents left, because usually in a normal situation, the parent is sending money and clothes and gifts so that you're able to, you know, floss and be okay back home. But you're told to be grateful for that, not to miss them, not to cry, because at least you're getting things. Right. In True's case, she's not really getting the things, but also I still wanted her voice to be out there, like the child left behind. I wanted her to also have her own narrative, you know, as well. So, yeah, it was important to have her in the story.
Another thing that the book does beautifully is explore the complexity of relationships with mother figures, mm-hmm. you know, so the relationship between Patsy and Mama G, the relationship between True and Patsy, but also True and Mama G, but also True and Marva, yes, Roy's wife or partner, and I found that very interesting. I found it interesting who we call mother, how we're mothered, and even to some extent Patsy's relationship with Cicely. You know, there's almost like a because you know, there's clearly a relationship there, but you get a sense that Patsy reveres Cicely in a way that goes beyond a lover's affections, if that makes any sense. There's a sense of idolizing Cicely in a way that you sometimes wonder: is she thinking about Cicely in this way because she's in love with her, or is it because mm-hmm. she's something that she can hold on to give her hope, you know? So it's like,
right.
It's like this weird, yes. It's a very interesting dynamic that you set up and it poses quite a lot of questions, but you do that very well. And I was interested in that choice of the mother figures, and exploring that complexity of what love mm-hmm. looks like. Cause even with Mama G's religion and all of that, you still felt a sense of love in
yes.
her own way, you know, that she had for her daughter and even her granddaughter.
Yeah, there's so much with this. It's so loaded because, you know, yes, I did want to set it up where Patsy, in addition to her her longing for Sicily, you know, how they met in the beginning, you know, in primary school, you know, Sicily chose Patsy, you know, and again, tapping into colorism, how, you know, a girl like that is who teachers would say would make it, you know, and for Patsy, who whose self-worth was already diminished, for Sicily to even look at her in the playroom, on the playground, and choose her as a friend was everything, and she latched onto that, and she became more than a friend. Yes, she did become a maternal figure, in a sense, right? And I was really playing around with the fact that as Black women, we're so primed to be maternal, we're primed to be mothers of the world, of society, of certain kinds of women. You know, that's actually further explored with the bathroom scenes where she was the one zipping and tucking and helping these women, these white women coming into the bathroom who would divulge information to her, you know, thinking she can help, you know, give them a hug, something, right? Because you are, as a Black woman, you're looked at as the protector, the one who's going to, you know, cradle or cuddle folk. And so, yes, playing around with that form, but defying that form, that concept, you know, for Patsy to dare walk away from motherhood itself, you know, yes, she ends up hurting her daughter, hurting her child, but kind of defying that, kind of walking away from that expectation itself. In terms of the generational trauma, though, yes, I did want to explore even deeper as the reason why, which is why I went into Mama G's past, you know, because we tend to mother the way how we were mothered. It could be a choice, but mostly subconscious. And so for Patsy, she internalized a lot watching her own mother, you know, watching the depression that her mother was going through. I mean, yes, there was not the term to define what depression was, but her mother was ultimately escaping, you know, and that escape was a church, you know, and I forgot to mention earlier that, you know, there are two forms of escape among working class Jamaicans. You know, there's escape of coming to the US or the UK or Canada where, you know, you dream of better opportunities, but if you don't get that visa, right, if you're denied, because those visas are still hard to get, many defeated Jamaicans turn to the church. So like Mama G, she turns to her escape. Jesus is her escape. And I wanted to explore that. They don't speak about that. You know, they never had a conversation about those things, about the past. But you could see that generationally it was passed down to Patsy, she's not able to make sense of it and just ends up running away. You know, fearing that she would do the same thing to True and hoping that it stops at True. And so that's something I wanted to, that's why I love writing, you know, characters and having their mothers in the book as well, so it could make sense of what's really going on with them psychologically, mentally, you know, and emotionally, you know, what informs certain choices, you know, as devastating as walking away from a 5-year-old toddler, you know, to go to a new country to reinvent yourself. You know, there's a reason behind that. There's always two sides of the story. And, you know, I heard those stories growing up. They were untold stories. They were hush-hush. They were gossip. And I always, you know, I guess as an artist, I've always been more curious about the voice that's not there. I'm always curious about that person who never really gets the chance to tell their side of the story. And my imagination starts brewing, starts, you know, unraveling, kind of to kind of inform or kind of make up stories around what could possibly have gone wrong. And so in a Patsy's case, you know, that woman that we hear people whispering about, like, oh, you know, she left her child and she never looked back. I'm curious about those women. And that's why, for me, it was important for me to give her a world, an interior world, with a past linked back to her mother, Mama G.
Yeah. You touched on colorism, and another thing that this book does beautifully is explore the diversity of the Black experience. There are examples of, you know, internalized racism and class and, you know, I look at someone like Marcus and even Alan at the restaurant, you know, these people that want to not be associated with their past and fully assimilate into the world that they're in, which I thought was very interesting. And I'm curious about that. I'm curious about, and even just the xenophobia as well. Like you touched on the xenophobia between Black immigrants and African Americans. You know, mm-hmm. that tension and the impact of racism. The fact that racism, as a system of control, makes people that have a limited access to resources and opportunities turn against each other in these very interesting and complex ways. And yes. It was interesting how you explored that and explored it so beautifully through Patsy's eyes. But I was curious about that. I was curious about those choices, mm-hmm. to open up, you know, the complexities of these mm-hmm. these experiences as Patsy was seeing them as a dark skinned woman. In both worlds, not just Jamaica, but also in Brooklyn.
Yes, I'm happy you asked that. You know, when I read stories documenting the immigrant experience, not only did I see a void in or a lack in capturing the true essence, the true experiences of working class immigrants who are coming here not to school, you know, are working in the tech industry or wherever, the opportunities that highly educated middle to upper class immigrants have access to. But I was also seeing the void in the Patsies or in the immigrants who, there was lack of interaction with Black Americans. You know, I've always seen the interactions with white Americans because, of course, I mean, you're working for them. Those are the jobs that they end up getting as nannies. So, of course, there's the interactions with mothers and parents. But I wanted to see more of an interaction with African-Americans and the discussion around that, you know, what you are told about African-Americans as immigrants. And Patsy questioning that, you know, because, you know, to come to a country where you realize that there are multiple people living here, right? Blacks, whites, Hispanics, you know, you have to actually now, you know, be a part of that community and see yourself relative to that community. So Patsy's now coming as a working class Black woman. And, you know, immediately in America, she's aware. I mean, not that she wasn't aware of her race before. She's immediately aware that she is a Black woman in America. And she's existing among other Blacks who have been here before her, Blacks who were brought here on slave ships. And so when she landed in East New York and saw that, you know, there is a hierarchy, you know, in terms of, you know, Cicely saying to her, via Marcus, as you said, rightfully in the question, who distances himself, that, oh, you know, those people, you know, they are bad influences, right? And Patsy questioning the fact that even, why would Cicely even buy into that? Because she's like, both of them are coming from a country that has already erased them, dismissed them as working class Jamaicans. You know, a country that they claim but never claim them back because of their class, because of the color of their skin. And so to now be aware of that, that America, you know, the land of the golden roads and all of that, does the same exact thing to its own people. You know, she's realizing that she's no different from an African-American person, you know, who was never given opportunities in a country that's their own. And I wanted that to broaden that discussion. And also the irony of it all, of the fact that she, by opening her mouth and saying she's from Jamaica, that people don't see the individual, they see the beaches and they see the resorts and the, oh my God, I'd love to visit, or oh, I had visited before for my anniversary or my birthday or whatever. But then, you know, again, the fact that you, if you know, the scene of the woman at the bus stop who said those things to Patsy, but yes, it was the first to grab her purse when two Black men passed by. You know, and Patsy's saying to herself, how can a woman like that, who's afraid of Black men, how would she fear in a country full of them, right? And so the irony that, yes, we do have all these white tourists coming to the island in flocks, but there's no interaction with the black masses. And I think it's kind of also in the conversation with my first book, Here Comes the Sun, where, you know, visitors come to the island every day for or view or hills or beaches, all those beautiful things, but never spoke to the staff, you know, or talked down to them, or never you know, I've never even look and see that they're the ones cleaning up after them, you know? And so I guess it kind of forces a conversation. Like, you know, we are not invisible, you know? We, you know, look at us, hear us, see us, right? And, you know, we are human beings just like you are, right? And so it's really an extension in that conversation. I wanted to really hold up a mirror, you know, especially for those who tote the fact that, well, yes, they can come to a Black country and they're dismissed people from that country when they're in their territory. Mm. And even their own, dismiss their own people because of the color of their skin.
Yeah. And another bold and powerful choice that you make in the book is the use of Jamaican patois, which I really loved. And I loved when she gets to New York and she sort of chastises Cicely because she's now, you know, she can easily switch on and off, you know, to sort of assimilate into this new world that she mm-hmm. now inhabits. And I loved that. And I loved how it was just, you know, it completely makes sense because this is Patsy's world. Of course, this is how she would speak. But I wonder where that the boldness came for you as the writer to sort of go, I'm going to do this, and if and the reader will have to. We'll have to work through it, you know, even if it takes them some time, they're going to have to work through it. And I love that. I thought it was beautiful. But I'm curious as to how that came about.
Thank you. So I always say Zora Neale Hurston has always been my biggest influence, especially when it comes down to language, you know, how she boldly, you know, writes in dialect, you know, the dialogue, she puts it in dialect. And, you know, when I was a young writer coming up, I questioned that. You know, I wasn't this bold. You know, I was told in the beginning that, oh, you know, somebody who's not privy to the culture or the accent might be confused. And I used to believe that. But now I realize that I want to stay true to the characters. And, you know, no two Jamaicans would be speaking to each other without our dialect, without our language, especially if they're unobserved, right? There'll be some inkling, something. And so I wanted to put that in the book. I wanted people to, you know, if a Jamaican picks up my book tomorrow or today, I want them to see themselves, to hear themselves, you know, not to put it down and say, this is not us. This is not who we are, you know, which used to happen to me all the time growing up in Jamaica. When I read books that supposedly was about us, but it was mostly caricatures. I did not want to do that, to my readers. And even if the persons are not familiar with Jamaican language, I also want, you know, I provide enough context for them to get it, you know, to slow down, just to see us even more on the page and hear us. Because the intention is for people to slow down, you know, because to see the people who don't usually get seen in our society. So that was really important for me to put that in there. And also kind of reclaiming the language that I lost. Because, you know, growing up in Jamaica, you're told not to speak patois. You know, you're told you're backwards and uneducated if you're speaking it. And that's the first, that's actually the first way of erasing people's identity, because language is identity. And so for you to tell people not to speak their language, that's, you know, that's cruel. And so for me as an artist, I have to reclaim that, put it back in books so that the generation of Jamaicans coming up can actually see that we have a language. You know, right now for my third book, for example, there is a dying language that a lot of us, we don't even remember it, you know, that the Maroons spoke, you know, Cromanty. And, you know, like if there were people who could write books and document those languages in our libraries, we would have had that still. But no, now we don't have that. You know, so what would happen with patois in general when people in Jamaica, the government is still trying to erase that from schools, you know, still trying to tell children speak standard English, you know, so it's just unfair. So for me, it's important for me to now document all of that before that happens.
And another thing that you do quite well in highlighting the impact of slavery and colonialism in Jamaica is even with hair. I mean, it's very subtle, the moments when it happens, but when Patsy first goes to the unemployment office, and she's at the job agency, and she notices the woman's got these beautiful dreadlocks, and they're just, you know, and she just can't help it. And it's interesting,
yes,
how she's sort of juxtaposing that with her own internalized standards of beauty from back home in Jamaica about who is allowed to wear beautiful locks. And
yes,
it's interesting because there's been a conversation just more recently around I think it was workplaces in Jamaica in the news recently, where there was a ban in schools, where there was a ban of these hairstyles, and this idea of beauty that is still very much rooted in that very Eurocentric notion of what is acceptable and mm-hmm. what isn't acceptable, and how people take on these legacies without necessarily questioning how they arrived at this point. And that was something that you were doing really, really well, and I was enjoying that. I'm curious about that side of Jamaica's history, because in many ways it's Patsy's story, but it feels also like a commentary on a country that, like, Patsy's this metaphor of a country that could be so much more had it not been stifled, had it not been had it not been stifled by, whether it was slavery or colonialism, you know.
Right.
And the impact of that and what that has then meant for generations of Jamaicans and their access to choices and opportunities and things like that, and this idea of what would Jamaica be like if it wasn't bound by those things. And I found that quite interesting. and I don't yes. necessarily know if that was what you were trying to get at, but this was something that really struck me through reading Patsy's story.
That, I mean, well said. I mean, you summed that up so well, and that's on point, because that's even why I have a Ras Norbert in the book, the believe me, believe me not, you know, there's gold buried in your backyards. And literally saying, yeah, we do have so much in terms of resources. We have so much back home. If only the government can tap into that, you know, many of us would never leave the country if you can actually look at our youths, look at our people and give them opportunities, improve the schools, you know, for example, free education. You know, education is not free in Jamaica. So you have a lot of boys and girls who can't even afford to go to school, much less buy uniforms and books and all those things. And so so it's kind of like a subtle commentary without beating readers over the head with it, you know, in terms of how a country can be so great if we do tap into the wealth that we have on the island. And also if we shed our post-colonial scars, if we are still so bound by them, you know, the fact that just 2 weeks ago, the kid, the little girl was told that she can't come to school with dreadlocks, right? That's our natural hair. Like, how can you tell a black person is telling a black person, you can't wear your natural hair? Yeah, no, in Bob Marley's words, that's mental slavery. So we're still mentally enslaved. And I do feel that if we are going to stay that way, then we can't be great as a country. I mean, yes, we're independent. I guess we're, 56 years old at this point. And I feel like we're still questioning what's independence. You know, even this Independence Day this year, this whole conversation about dreadlocks and natural hair was actually happening during our Independence Day weekend, you know, just to shed light on how far our country has come, which is not far at all, right? I remember growing up in the 80s and 90s and hearing our mothers and grandmothers talk about not being able to work at certain places because they don't have the right skin color, right? If you're not light skin, or with European aesthetics, you can't have certain positions. Have we changed? I don't know, because when you look at it too, we have a lot of kids who are bleaching their skin to be lighter, right? In order for them to feel worthy, to feel visible. And people would look at them and scoff, like, oh my gosh, you're so backward and ignorant. No, they're responding to something implicit in our culture, right, that we need to address as Jamaicans in order for us to free ourselves, because we're still enslaved, in my opinion. And if we're going to continue like that, then more people are going to leave, and there's definitely going to be a brain drain, which has happened. It's happening. You know, it's just ironic that, you know, most of our artists or writers have left. Most of us are here writing. You know, we're not there in Jamaica. You know, so it's a, I mean, I won't, you know, I'm still optimistic in that things can improve. Maybe it might take the two generations removed coming up to help. But we'll see what we can actually do to really untangle everything so far in terms of, you know, the our colonized minds and, you know, move forward.
It's interesting hearing you talking about that, obviously, given the context that we're in, the Black Lives Matter movement, mm-hmm. Since June, you know, these conversations around racial injustice and what is at the heart of it, you know, what's at the heart of the economic disadvantage that many communities, Black communities, have and have faced, and the legacy of things like slavery, colonialism.
Right.
And this idea that the conversation should not be focused on the individuals themselves, because that's what, you know, racism generally tends to do, to distract us from the bigger issue. But this idea that you really do have to go far back to understand, I mean, you touched on this particularly with intergenerational trauma, this idea that to understand Patsy is to understand Mama G, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also the sense of to understand why people who are dark-skinned would want to lighten their skin, mm-hmm. you really have to go through the history to understand that,
right?
You know, to situate that context, and that the only way that you can break that is by understanding that and going and consciously moving, sort of knowing why you're now making the choices that you're making.
Yes.
And it's a very difficult one, obviously, because it's not a short-term project or work. Like it's a commitment to sort of be vigilant with that level of wanting to break or dismantle racism in that way.
Yes, it's easier said than done, honestly. You know, but somehow, you know, people would ask me, for example, you know, what's the solution? And I honestly have no solutions. I think right now, maybe cultivate or nurture the minds of the younger Jamaicans coming up, or the younger groups coming up. You know, something as simple as having books that represent who they are as people, you know, or toys that's, you know, if we think about gender, for example, toys, things that, you know, young Black girls could look to, you know, see themselves, feel empowered, you know, so that they are not there feeling defeated, feeling that, okay, if they don't look a certain way, then, you know, then that's it for them. So it could be something as simple as that, like starting micro, and then hopefully, you know, that would actually help, you know, with something macro. But right now, I do feel like that in terms of like, or the conversation that we're having now, it I don't know how far we are in terms of the changes, you know, but I feel like, like I said, I'm actually optimistic that it can happen, definitely starting with the next generation.
And I guess I want to find out how Patsy came to you. Like, mm-hmm. How did Patsy find you?
Yeah. Patsy actually came to me in a very interesting way. She was writing to her mother constantly. So it was a series of letters, their mama letters, you know, her just talking about her days in Brooklyn working as a nanny. You know, so it was like a diary entry every day. Dear mama, this is what I did today. And I spent a whole year writing those letters back and forth from Patsy to Mama G. And at the time, I did not foresee any of the internal conflicts that ultimately that became the book Patsy. But one thing that happened was that when I was working on Here Comes the Sun, you know, just with the edits, like sending it off into the world to my editor, I was at a residency, and I realized that another voice came to me in that sense of character. And this was another first-person narrative talking about being abandoned, talking about living in Jamaica, navigating life without a mother. And somehow, you know, I think it was in the fall, I began to link the two together, the Patsy narrative, the Dear Mama narrative, and this other narrative, which ultimately became true, the child left behind. And I realized, well, Patsy's saying all these things to her mother in these letters, but there's something being left out. She's leaving out a lot of things. She's leaving out how she's really doing in America, which, you know, she was in that one room, still even in that first draft. But in addition to that, Patsy wasn't telling me, the author, something, that she left a whole child behind, a whole five-year-old daughter, you know. And so it was really sitting on that project and working through that, because I myself kind of refused to believe that Patsy would actually do that, because I wanted to like Patsy. You know, I judged Patsy initially, you know, when I found that out. But I still continued the Dear Mama letters, and then draft two, I just trashed that. I was like, you know what, Patsy, you're going to tell me the truth. And that's really what happened. She ended up revealing a lot more in Close Third. And so it became a book of this one woman trying to find her place in the world, left the daughter behind with hopes of rekindling with this best friend, Cicely, whose voice also came to me as well. You know, Cicely also had her own point of view. All of that it got left out in the last bit of the book production. But it was something that Patsy's story was important for me to tell, because, like I said, I wanted to capture that working class undocumented immigrant story. I felt it was important to write it because even my own father being undocumented, I really crave stories like that. Like, I wanted to see the stories like that on the bookshelves. And the one other person that I've respected in the past who have done that for me was Edwidge Danticat, you know, who also documents the Haitian American immigrant experience. And I was always fascinated with how she does that so well. And so I wanted to continue that with in terms of the Jamaican immigrant experience. But not only, I mean, you don't have to be a Jamaican immigrant to identify it. It's the immigrant experience, you know, in general, you know, what people go through. And so as the book, you know, became a book, I realized that, you know, there were different themes that were added to it. But yeah, that was really it in a nutshell, became that thing, that project I couldn't let go of.
I think you did a beautiful job. As you said, you know, as much as it is a Jamaican experience, there is a universality to it. I mean, I saw a lot of myself through Patsy's eyes and through Patsy's world, but then I also saw people that I know who've had to make those choices. Mm. and I also saw the hope that lies with someone with True, you know, and what that looks like when communities come together to support, you know, when communities are able to put aside a lot of that sort of stuff, you know, and invest in the younger generation, just as you said before. So it was just a delight, and I truly thank you for writing this book. It's just, the characters will sit with me for a very, very long time. It's been a joy. It's been a joy to read the book, but an even greater joy be in conversation with you. So thank you very much, Nicole.
Same, Scintilla. Thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe to and rate our channel.